We're going to start, so if you can be quiet. My name's Jan Rothschild, and I'm the director of the Duff's Poetry Series. And it's my pleasure this evening to introduce Robin Mack, who is a St. Louis poet and a painter. And this is the third time that she's read at the Duff's Poetry Series, and we're glad to have her back. She's living in Cape Cod right now, and she has performed with the APAC Theater, and her collaborative audiovisual memory happenings, Radio Blackout, has been presented at Webster and Florissant Valley Colleges. She's been featured in the Riverfront Times and the St. Louis Globe Democrat, and she's also been an associate editor of the River Styx magazine. She was in the last two issues, she was an associate editor. And she received her BFA in painting from Webster College and an MA in writing from Washington University. She's in residency at the Fine Arts Work Center in Provincetown, Massachusetts, and she's working on her second collection of poems, Letters to Myself. And she told me that she's going to be reading on January 18th at the Berta Walker Gallery in Provincetown and the Westside YMCA in New York on May the 13th. And she hosts a late night jazz and poetry program on WOMR in Cape Cod, so if any of you are up there, you can catch it. And it's my pleasure to introduce or reintroduce Robin Mack, and we're glad to welcome her back to St. Louis for Christmas.
I'm really glad to be back in St. Louis. Feels good. I'd like to read tonight from a work in progress. The title is tentatively Chronicles Encounters with Marks Felt Sideways. And it comes out of a struggle with learning to accept yourself. Self-acceptance when society says that you have to conform or be some other kind of way. And it's okay if you understand why you don't accept yourself, and when you accept the reasons why you shouldn't accept yourself, then you get into trouble. And I've sort of dealt with that and come out with that, and I'm very happy with this project, and I hope you will like it too. Chronicles Encounters with Marks Felt Sideways. She was always around beautiful people, not the elite jet set, not those who flew to Morocco or squandered small fortunes in Curacao or Saint-Tropez. She was always around those whose beauty was more simplified, striking yet curiously mundane. Their beauty could not be bought. For them, there would never be the small, insignificant scars behind their ears or on the bikini line. They would never need to have tummy tucks or butt tucks, stapling or facelifts. Their world was just as biased as the jet set one, though. Only the dividing line between the haves and the have-nots would never be determined by money. This was a cruel group. They did not have a begging barter. They were perfect from the beginning of their lives, and no matter how hard she tried, she would never be more than around them, circling their chatty magazine faces like a fierce, ugly buzzard. She remembered being 12, the summer of her best friend's birthday party. Aunt Shell, she lived on the first floor of their four-family flat. They had played, shared, fallen out of trees together, become blood sisters by pricking their fingers with a shard of glass, put thumb to thumb and swore they would never leave each other, but they did. They both moved away to separate parts of town. Their friendship took more effort. Phone calls became extremely important. A half-hour drive, spur-of-the-moment activities were out of the question. Friendship required planning and perhaps more care than 12-year-olds could give. First, Aunt Shell had called her in that newly aristocratic voice. "Please come to my party," she said. All of her cousins, uncles, playaunts, and play sisters would be there, she said. "Oh, you know, Terry and Carl Richard. We're having it in Webster Groves." "Oh, your aunt's house." Aunt Shell's aunt. She owned a motel. Her husband had been killed in a car accident on the way to the Kentucky Derby. Lena was her name. Mm-hmm. Light-skinned, hands in white gloves. She had visited Lena's house once with Aunt Shell. Lena served them pastel ice cream and glass dishes, the kind upper-class white kids ate their cereal out of on Kellogg's commercials. There was a staircase and the greenest lawn ever. Books, lots of books, a break front full of Haviland and Noritake china. They, too, were fine. Fine people, fine house, fine life, opaque, beautiful, delicate, meticulous. The invitation came a little bent on one corner. It had come with the Social Security checks, two checks, one for her and her sister, one invitation that the mailman had shoved into the little tinny apartment box. She recognized the handwriting, self-consciously elegant. There was tissue paper inside, script which was raised from the paper, warm beige, elegant, meticulous. Her mother had taken her downtown on Saturday, groceries and something new to wear. Her mother managed their money well, but she often wondered how much further it would have gone if she hadn't had two children who were extremely hard to fit, or if she hadn't always argued and insisted with herself to buy good things. She would never let them wear cheap clothes, though it would have been nice to get by once in a while. So her two children had good things, but few things. The oldest girl was tall, with a bubble in her belly like her aunt, and big feet, size 10 like her mother. She didn't mind this so much. One's shoes could always be borrowed. But the other girl was something else. She had a bubble in her belly, only it was a big one, and her feet were short and wide. She did not wear 10s. She did not have a waist. Her legs were too large for normal knee socks. She was fat. God, she was fat, just like her daddy. Solid fat from age 2. Her mother had loved her, a big, fat baby, cute, big eyes, pensive mouth. But the fat baby grew and grew, got bigger and fatter. She lost her cuteness. And ever since her mother had fed her more, greased her legs with Vaseline in the winter so that her limbs looked like two enormous turkey drumsticks under her uniform skirt. Mama's little turkey leg, fat baby, thank God she wasn't black, just greased and squeezed into everything she had. Yes, she was just like her daddy. He had spoiled her with toys from business trips, stuffed animals, hand-tooled Mexican wallets, and food. Lord, the food. Her mother would cook dinner and then leave for work. The two girls would eat together and then again when their father came home. And sister was just a woman with the same blood and last name. It neither excused her peculiarities or languished her uniqueness. It just made her sister and closer to the echo of her mother. They smoked Salems and dyed their hair number 21 red penny. There were three women in the house, all strangers to each other. Watching their own craziness, it was like living in the theater. One handled the costumes, lots of bangles, beads and chains tied up with the bed sheets. The other one sang songs and acted out of fantasies, imitating Sarah Bernhardt, only manic depressive. Mother played critic, and after she let them listen to the free music in themselves, she would snatch them from the stage, close the shows, insulting the things about them that reminded her of herself, words inching around their necks like vaudeville hooks. The daughters were panned like bad off-Broadway, the curtain coming down on lives they were trying to live as sanely as possible. They remembered their childhood, spent waiting in the wings. Sister resigned herself to being ordinary, though she carried visions of opening nights with music, sequins, and caribou boas. Reality was two kids in matching sweaters to skirts. Every day her dreams faded from 9 to 5. The other one withdrew like a shrinking violet, holding herself against even the smallest ventures into the world. She walked from room to room thinking of psychiatrists, pills, and nervous breakdowns, her heart forgetting the magic in Copland tunes and Ropart sonatas and the men she liked. Together they were trapped by things dark and falling apart. Everything they knew about love resembled standing water and dying roses. They were erased like the drawings of children who constantly mess up, poking holes with graphite and crayons, smudging and scribbling outside of margins, crumpled states with scrawls accounting for their lives. Their images askew and totally abandoned, the colors in themselves left hopeless and fugitive. They would walk a block to Reed's for concrete malts and oatmeal cookies the size of portholes. Every day they would eat two dinners, everyone except their mother. Every day they would start like some bizarre ritual, eating and eating popsicles, candy, cakes, snow cones, and mother begged her husband to stop. She would come home from work and search the garbage can. This was her ritual, and together they played the game. The father and his two daughters would eat and attempt to hide the evidence. Food wrappers and cellophane would be shoved to the bottom of the trash can. In comes mother searching. She would sit there at the kitchen table with her lap full of ratty, wet, and dripping wrappers, crumbs from ice cream and cake. Whose birthday was it today? And she would cry. She would sob and say to him, "You're killing our child." Daddy would stand there and be sad. He had grown up fat, but he had found her a raving, red-headed beauty, classic nose, milk-toast skin. He was fat, but he had found her, found love. They were married now. He had no conception of impending doom. He did not know that fat, ugly Negro girls do not get married. They do not have babies. He did not know that how they suffered, how they chafed through their legs, how they always seemed to be made of sweat, even in the winter. He did not know that they rubbed holes in their tights at the meeting of their thighs. He was a man, and a fat man could be loved, like Jackie Gleason or Fatty Arbuckle. A fat girl is just anonymous, being seen but never being asked. So Daddy fed them out of love or ignorance he didn't know. Now they were buying a dress, trying to buy a dress, something to wear to Aunt Shell's party. There were five choices on the rack, five ugly choices. A solid yellow, bold and bright. She thought of school buses. No, that would never do. The print, oh, the print. Pretty but too delicate for a girl her size. Lace, she would look like something sugared over. A big fat sugared cupcake. No. She searched through the rack again, stripes. Yes, vertical, slimming, subdued, always tasteful. She held the dress up to her daughter's shoulders. Yes, she liked the stripes on her. They don't call attention to you, her mother said. No, they make you anonymous. The fall Kathy came to visit was the first time I had ever heard of Akron, Ohio. I thought everyone there was light-skinned and half-white like her and made of black springy curls. She came rolling up the curb in her daddy's big blue Cadillac, lace and velvet spilling about her shoulders. Side by side, we looked like before and after pictures. All the neighborhood kids ran up to look at her and pat her hair, and in some ways, I hated her because I was being taught to want to be like that, and I had neither Glinda or the wizard to make it so. My lips curved around the Mississippi, and I was the color of Muscle Shoals clay, raw sienna and alizarin crimson, with hair that couldn't decide if it wanted to be a Brillo pad or an instant umbrella. Ah, a color girl, 10 cents plain. Words tumbling out of my mouth, drawled and connected like vines of Cheney Briar, paying homage to Juju and Gree-Gree Cajun talk. A red nigga every time I looked into the mirror. A red nigga 27 light years away from anything like Akron. A red nigga with a Cherokee in her step. My reflection, the faces of my great-grandmothers, Trinidadians and slaves and kettle cloth hoop skirts hanging out the wash. But I was taught to hate myself. From age 10, the year my mother decided I was not too young for permanents and bleaching creams, I bear a scar in the middle of my forehead from vicious experiments, ropes and constrictions, the brand for cheap cattle with hoof and mouth disease. I am 1,000 color girls who mistakenly dyed their hair the day after the dance, who left intimate spaces and bottles along the sink, searching for ways to abort, waiting in exile, for Dobie Gillis and fairy godmothers to reverse the stroke of 12. For years paying dues for impossible odds, ignoring the roads opened to me by ancestors laying roses to the past and myself. Valentine messages from spirits and ordinary colored folks returning like 5 o'clock shadows. The spirit in me is no longer missing, like the girl who ran from ringing doorbells, open blinds, and storefront windows. She is no longer anonymous or absent, but a woman freeing the melody, emerging from the closet, singing like Sly Stone, "Thank you for letting me be myself again." They poked and pulled in the dressing room, 3 mirrors, front, back, and side, good Lord. Her hair was mussed, but the dress was on. "It looks good on you," she said, "but you ought to want to lose some of that weight. You're getting older now, you're going to want boys to take you out. Don't no boy like no girl that makes 2 of him." Fish hooks. Always a fish hook in what she said. A compliment would come from her mouth like that delicious bit of bait floating in the water. The bite, always the bite. The girl smiled, hearing the compliment, and snagged the fish hook. The tagline, her mother's truth, a double-edged sword. Her mother used to fish hook her daddy before he died. She nagged him, and he would take headache powders, thousands of them. He got used to them. So used to them, he would take them dry. Every time she baited a fish hook, he would take a headache powder. One day he fell down in a den, overcome with a cramp in his stomach. His daughter was terrified. She called her mother. The sister stood and watched. A little girl voice was on the other end of the phone trying to tell her mother daddy fell out, her voice strong yet sobbing. Her mother said, "I'm at work. Don't you call me no more. If your daddy don't want to go to the doctor, ain't nothing I can do." Click. A big little girl quietly hung up the phone. Alligator tears welled in her eyes. She sensed the impending doom her father had never seen. She walked stiffly to the bathroom and wet a towel with cold water. She thought, this is what they do on television, like boiling water for a pregnant woman. She did not know what else to do. Call an ambulance? She was a little girl. Ambulance was serious and red and loud and scary. People died in them. Once her daddy had taken her and her sister on police call. There would be grisly stories for the newspaper. There were ambulances at night, she remembered. Her daddy was only getting the story, but she and her sister had stood and watched like little mini reporters, only they didn't have pencils or notepads or cameras or microphones. But they had eyes, young innocent eyes watching death jump out of every corner like a Halloween spook house. And there had been ambulances screaming and angry with their motors gunning and doors flying open. There were swift-footed attendants with deep maroon stains on their pants. Dry blood, old blood, she knew the look of it. It scared her even then. There were gunshot wounds and stabbings and cuttings. Black people on Saturday night had mercy. This is where we dwell, with the history of ourselves laying open in rows from Cheops to corner tenements, from Johannesburg, trees and drums, splintered and parched mahogany, olive and gold. A Dogon girl waits for a star. 50 years, the griot tells her, 50 years of apartheid breaking her steps. She dances a massacred ballet. From Chicago, 5 men stop just outside of Skokie. "Hey, pull over there, nigga. What you doing in a Jewish neighborhood after 5 o'clock? 2 white cops manifest their paranoia with a routine throwdown. From Sharpeville, blood and parchment photographs, 100 pages of ash and gunfire, impossibilities in military regalia, clasping chains. From St. Louis, we live belly up on the dreams of pioneers run backwards out of town from the courthouse, sons and daughters for sale and nameless, Pruitt Igoe symbolizing the vision of our time. Backward reality spreading across the Mississippi. And we're living on the Cape Town fringe, the flash of lightning in a dark blue sky. Everything we are subject to consideration. We are native foreigners in exile. Oh, say can you see the plantings of our feet, the decades of hand-spinning clay, settlers' tracks and ambush parties, captives alone and unattended, asleep in cold sleep, asleep in death sleep, asleep wide awake with our eyes shut, from Zaire to West Bell, traveling through secret doors and tunnels, bridges to small nightmares for dreams we never had. She would never want to ride roughshod speeding through a red light. She would never want a policeman to make a report. A report always meant dead on arrival. She would never want to lose her daddy while people were doing their jobs. She placed a cool towel on his forehead. The cramping had subsided somewhat. "What did Mama say?" he asked. She did not answer him. She did not want to think of her mother now. Her father lay there for a while and got up. The furrow in her brow lifted. He told her not to worry, to go to sleep. But she did not sleep until he had come out of the bathroom. She watched the little strip of light under the door. He spent the longest time in there, then click, shut. She turned on her stomach and fell asleep. She noticed it every time she went to the bathroom. It was always visible after he left. The seat would be up and she would notice the pus-colored stains around the rim of the bowl. Was this some sexual emission that she did not know about? She longed to touch it, smear it, place it under her junior microscope. Her sister came in the bathroom before she had a chance to let the seat down. "What's this?" she asked. Her sister took her eyes from the medicine cabinet mirror and peered at the bowl. "Looks like bloody pee," she said. "Your daddy's peeing blood. Peeing blood. How did you do that? How did men do that?" She knew enough to know that men did not have periods. There was nothing in their apparatus to make them pee blood. She let the seat down and flushed the toilet and flushed it and flushed it. "There's nothing wrong," she said to herself, but she could not really believe it. Her daddy died that summer, 3 days before her birthday. She had watched him slow down, lose his appetite. His smiles had come tired and weak. She visited him in the hospital once. The family had gotten special permission from the doctor. The doctor knew he was not going to make it. "Let her see her daddy now before he gets any worse." In his last days, he had nosebleeds and had gone blind. His body was wreaking such havoc on him now, such revenge. He took one last breath and died one night with his wife standing there. There had been a priest, darkness and extreme unction. The nurses packed his body and turned off the lights. He seemed larger under a white sheet. He died of uremic poisoning and fish hooks and headache powders. They had all lost their daddy. Her mother's shoulders were like anchors. She remembered her daughter's fretful little voice and how she had done nothing to help her. They would have to go home now, her and the priest, and try to tell daddy's best girl that it was all over, and there had been no pain, no pain, no pain. "I will always have these colors to follow me. These boxes of light and sound exits the length of my life, colors to remind me of ponytail ribbons, birthday parties, and Palisades Park. Merry-go-rounds with Barbie dolls dressed in swatches of silk and satin, the scent of patou and aioli from my mother's kitchen, the rustle of her skirts and starch in the closet, contagiando movements and chiaroscuro calling me back. Summers in New Jersey, Vauxhall and Passaic, lace antimacassars and pastel sorbet, my grandmother braiding her metallic hair, winding like Mexican silver around her head. My sister, dressed in pearls and lemon chiffon, wears a scapular beneath her bodice. St. Teresa and Mother Mary going to the dance. There's Italian ice on the corner, the vendor and the painter know. The coolness of phthalo, yellow ochre and titanium. A square of pink taffeta sticks in the subway door. We leave Valentine's here. To the Midwest of quilts and cobblestones where the colored leave their dreams in antique shops with Lafayette, DeMille, and Lewis and Clark. To ride north to the Ville and Sumner High, Soldan and Windermere Place. The oaks speak of white gloves, fried heads and do-rags, rhythm and blues floating on the Mississippi like dropped camellias. Where is my home? I unpack boxes and mementos, scrapbooks of heartache and death, spaces overcast with shadow and pain. Yet I collect happiness like so many photographs and press roses in the yearbooks of debutantes in 1965 and savor the memories of times fallen inward, remembrances of past selves talking inside. These are the spaces between St. Louis and Ocean Park, the distances of lines drawn parallel to territories of labor, halfway around the world breaking apart and back again, maps created for color girls with sparkle paints and watercolors, Payne's gray, azo yellow, and cadmium orange. Jimi Hendrix's purple haze, incense and peppermints, the doors open to spaces reaching to claim me, following me down, giving me direction like a rainbow in the street, a break of sun and music in cloudy skies. The limousine came for them, but not before all the phone calls, telegrams, and visits to the dressmaker. Her youngest daughter's dress was specially made, Irish white linen, three box pleats, a Peter Pan collar, and three-quarter length sleeves. Her mother and older sister wore black, black and white. There they were, mourning and innocence. They wore lace mantillas falling to their shoulders like crocheted hair. She did not want to see her daddy. She did not want to go to the funeral parlor and see him or smell that smell, the smell of death, embalming fluid, field flowers and sandalwood, a choking sweet musk. She had made such a scene when she saw him the first time. He was cold and dead and stiff. His skin felt like a fish's skin, clammy and damp. She had cried so hard for so long, and she would always remember this sorrow. It was not fair to lose your daddy and to cry like this at 8 years old. It was not fair to be burying someone you loved 3 days before your birthday. It made her ache. The same ache she had when she knew she was being laughed at. The same ache she got when they chose sides for volleyball and nobody picked her. Someone would always shrug, an obligatory shrug, and take her. She would get a funny twitch in her stomach as if someone was trying to grab her belly into a fist. She had that ache now and would for the rest of her life. And this is for the girls who stood on the outside, the girls hanging on to fragments of themselves, the ones with the pressed hair that was never long enough, the skin which was never smooth enough, the girls with their pieces of dreams trying to fit lives into them. I remember standing on the fringes of a circle with a chattering of girls, some fair like chamois gloves, some smooth like sweet white chocolate, who were friends of the copper browns and the Brazilian cocos. These girls laughing with the strong white teeth, country club grins and ribbons, uniforms from private schools starched crisp like the edges of their parents' extensive lawns. The bottom of my skirt was always clenched in my fist, wringing wet and anxious. Me, always waiting to fit in, expecting the dress circle to be saved by the grace of God. But being Catholic, I knew the road to hell was paved with good intentions. And this is my poem to the hearts of those who never fit in, to those whose Valentines never came, those to whom a peppermint prom was more like a private hell because no one ever really understands the ravaged face and the made-up love letters you address to yourself. No one ever really understands why you cried into the whole cheesecake you ate at 16 or why the razors were missing from the bathroom cabinet. No one ever really seems to give a damn. But this is about coming through, about wading in the water, about sadness and euphoria. This is for coming through, for the walk through dreamland, a fantasy fragment, for never having been a part of the puzzle, but maybe seeing a picture of your own. This is for somehow making it to this point with your wings intact. So happy birthday, Sugar Blues. Let my words be your celebration. The flight from Never Never Land was a bitch, but you never had forgotten to clap for Tinkerbell the whole time. Thank you.